thing he had held in his hand could not have heard the shoes. It had the smallest, most wrinkled ears. For Homer Wells it was different. He did not imagine leaving St. Cloud's. The princes of Maine that Homer saw, the kings of New England that he imagined, they reigned at the court of St. Cloud's. They traveled nowhere. They didn't get to go to sea. They never even saw the ocean. But somehow, even to Homer Wells, Dr. Larch's benediction was uplifting, full of hope. These princes of Maine, these kings of New England, these orphans of St. Cloud's, whoever they were the heroes of their own lives. That much Homer could see in the darkness. That much Dr. Larch, like a father, gave him. Princely, even kingly behavior was possible, even at St. Cloud's. That seemed to be what Dr. Larch was saying. Homer Wells dreamed he was a prince. He lifted up his eyes to his king. He watched St. Larch's every move. It was the astonishing coolness of the thing that Homer couldn't forget. "Because it was dead, right?" he asked Dr. Larch. "That's why it was cool, right?" "Yes," said Dr. Larch. "In a way, Homer, it was never alive." "Never alive," said Homer Wells. "Sometimes," Dr. Larch said, "a woman simply can't make herself stop a pregnancy. She feels the baby is already a baby, from the first speck, and she has to have it, although she doesn't want it, and she can't take care of it. And so she comes to us and has her baby here. She leaves it here with us. She trusts us to find it a home." "She makes an orphan," said Homer Wells. "Someone has to adopt it." "Someone usually adopts it," Dr. Larch said. "Usually," said Homer Wells. "Maybe." "Eventually," Dr. Larch said. "And sometimes," said Homer Wells, "the woman doesn't go through with it, right? She doesn't go through with having the baby." "Sometimes," said Dr. Larch, "the woman knows very early in her pregnancy that this child is unwanted." "An orphan from the start," said Homer Wells. "You might say," said Wilbur Larch. "So she kills it," said Homer Wells. "You might say," said Wilbur Larch. "You might also say that she stops it before it becomes a child. She just stops it. In the first 3 or 4 months, the fetus, or the embryo, I don't say then the child, it does not quite have a life of its own. It lives off the mother. It hasn't developed." "It's developed only a little," said Homer Wells. "It hasn't moved independently," said Dr. Larch. "It doesn't have a proper nose," said Homer Wells, remembering it. On the thing he had held in his hand, neither the nostrils nor the nose itself had developed to its downward slope. The nostrils pointed straight out from the face, like the nostrils of a pig. "Sometimes," said Dr. Larch, "when a woman is very strong and knows that no one will care for this baby if she has it, and she doesn't want to bring a child into the world and try to find it a home, she comes to me, and I stop it." "Tell me again, what's stopping it called?" asked Homer Wells. "An abortion," Dr. Larch said. "Right," said Homer Wells, "an abortion." "And what you held in your hand, Homer, was an aborted fetus," Dr. Larch said. "An embryo, about 3 to 4 months." "An aborted fetus, an embryo, about 3 to 4 months," said Homer Wells, who had an irritating habit of repeating the pigtails of sentences very seriously, as if he were planning to read them aloud, like David Copperfield. "And that's why," Dr. Larch said patiently, "some of the women who come here don't look pregnant. The embryo, the fetus, there's just not enough of it for it to show." "But they all are pregnant," said Homer Wells. "All the women who come here, either they're going to have an orphan or they're going to stop it, right?" "That's right," Dr. Larch said. "I'm just a doctor. I help them have what they want, an orphan or an abortion." "An orphan or an abortion," said Homer Wells. Nurse Edna teased Dr. Larch about Homer Wells. "You have a new shadow, Wilbur," she said. "Dr. Larch," Nurse Angela said, "you have developed an echo. You've got a parrot following you around." "God or whatever, forgive me," wrote Dr. Larch, "I have created a disciple. I have a 13-year-old disciple." By the time Homer was 15, his reading of David Copperfield was so successful that some of the older girls in the girls' division asked Dr. Larch if Homer might be persuaded to read to them. "Just to the older girls?" Homer asked Dr. Larch. "Certainly not," said Dr. Larch. "You'll read to all of them."
"In the girls' division?"
Homer asked. "Well, yes," Dr. Larch said. "It would be awkward to have all the girls come to the boys' division."
"Right,"
said Homer Wells. "But do I read to the girls first or to the boys first?"
"The girls," Larch said. "The girls go to bed earlier than the boys."
"They do?" Homer asked.
"They do here," Dr. Larch said.
"And do I read them the same passage?" Homer asked. He was at the time in his fourth journey through David Copperfield, only his third aloud, at chapter 16. "I am a new boy in more senses than one." But Dr. Larch decided that girl orphans should hear about girl orphans, in the same spirit that he believed boy orphans should hear about boy orphans. And so he assigned Homer the task of reading aloud to the girls' division from Jane Eyre. It struck Homer immediately that the girls were more attentive than the boys. They were an altogether better audience, except for the giggles upon his arrival and upon his departure. That they should be a better audience surprised Homer, for he found Jane Eyre not nearly so interesting as David Copperfield. He was convinced that Charlotte Bronte was not nearly as good a writer as Charles Dickens. Compared to little David, Homer thought, little Jane was something of a whiner, a sniveler. But the girls in the girls' division always cried for more, for just one more scene when, every night, Homer would stop and hurry away, out of the building and into the night, racing for the boys' division and Dickens. The night, between the boys' and girls' division, frequently smelled of sawdust. Only the night had kept the memory of the original St. Clouds intact, dispensing in its secretive darkness the odors of the old sawmills and even the rank smell of the sawyer's cigars. "The night sometimes smells like wood and cigars," Homer Wells told Dr. Larch, who had his own memory of cigars. The doctor shuddered. The girls' division, Homer thought, had a different smell from the boys', although the same exposed pipes, the same hospital colors, the same dormitory discipline prevailed. On the one hand, it smelled sweeter. On the other hand, it smelled sicker. Homer had difficulty deciding. For going to bed, the boys and girls dressed alike, under vests and underpants. And whenever Homer arrived at the girls' division, the girls were already in their beds, with their legs covered, some of them sitting up, some of them lying down. The very few with visible breasts were usually sitting with their arms folded across their chests to conceal their development. All but one. The biggest one, the oldest one. She was both bigger and older than Homer Wells. She had carried Homer across the finish line of a particularly famous three-legged race. She was the one called Melanie, who was meant to be Melody, the one whose breasts Homer had mistakenly touched, the one who'd pinched his pecker. Melanie sat for the reading Indian style, on top of her bed covers, her underpants not quite big enough for her, her hands on her hips, her elbows pointed out like wings, her considerable bosom thrust forward. A bit of her big bare belly was exposed. Every night Mrs. Grogan, who directed the girls' division, would say, "Won't you catch cold outside your covers, Melanie?"
"Nope,"
Melanie would say. And Mrs. Grogan would sigh. It was almost a groan. That was her nickname, Mrs. Groan. Her authority rested in her ability to make the girls think that they had caused her pain by doing harm to themselves or each other. "Oh, that hurts me to see that," she would tell them when they fought, pulled hair, gouged eyeballs, bit each other in the face. "That really hurts me." Her method was effective with the girls who liked her, but it was not effective with Melanie. Mrs. Grogan was especially fond of Melanie, but she felt she was a failure at making Melanie like her. "Oh, it hurts me, Melanie, to see you catching cold outside your covers," Mrs. Grogan would say, "only partially clothed. That really hurts me." But Melanie would stay put, her eyes never leaving Homer Wells. She was bigger than Mrs. Grogan. She was too big for the girls' division. She was too big to be adopted. She's too big to be a girl, thought Homer Wells. Bigger than Nurse Edna, bigger than Nurse Angela, almost as big as Dr. Larch. She was fat, but her fat looked solid. Although he had not competed in the three-legged race for several years, Homer Wells also knew that Melanie was strong. Homer had decided not to compete as long as he would be paired with Melanie, and he would be paired with her as long as he was the oldest boy and she was the oldest girl. In reading aloud from Jane Eyre, Homer needed to keep his eyes off Melanie. One look at her would remind him of having his leg tied to hers. He sensed that she resented his withdrawal from the annual competition. He was also afraid that she might sense how he liked her heaviness. How fat, to an orphan, seemed such good fortune. The sweeter passages of Jane Eyre, too sweet for Homer Wells, brought tears to the eyes of the girls in the girls' division, and drew the most plaintive sighs and moans from Mrs. Grogan. But these same sweeter passages extracted from Melanie the most tortured breathing, as if sweetness provoked in her an anger barely restrainable. The end of chapter 4 provided Melanie with too much anger to restrain. "That afternoon lapsed in peace and harmony," Homer Wells read to them. Hearing Melanie hiss at the words peace and harmony, he bravely read on. "And in the evening, Bessie told me some of her most enchanting stories and sang me some of her sweetest songs," Homer continued, glad there was only one more sentence to get through. He saw Melanie's broad chest heave. "Even for me," chirped little Jane Eyre, "life had its gleams of sunshine." "Gleams of sunshine?" Melanie shouted in violent disbelief. "Let her come here. Let her show me the gleams of sunshine." "Oh, how it hurts me, Melanie, to hear you say that," Mrs. Grogan said.
"Sunshine?" Melanie said with a howl.
The younger girls crawled all the way under their bedcovers. Some of them began to cry.
"The pain this causes me, I don't know if I can bear it, Melanie," Mrs. Grogan said.
Homer Wells slipped away. It was the end of the chapter, anyway. He was due at the boys' division. This time the giggles attendant on his departure were mixed with sobs and with Melanie's derision.
"Gleams!" Melanie called after him.
"How this hurts us all," Mrs. Grogan said more firmly.
Outside, the night seemed full of new scents to Homer Wells. Mingled with the sawdust smell and the rank cigars, was that a waft of the raucous perfume drifting over him from the former whore hotel? And something like sweat from the bingo for money room? The river itself gave off a smell. In the boys' division, they were waiting for him. Some of the smaller ones had fallen asleep. Others were open-eyed, seemingly open-mouthed, like baby birds. Homer felt he was rushing from nest to nest, his voice feeding them as they always cried for more. His reading, like food, made them sleepy, but it often woke Homer up. He usually lay awake after the nightly benediction. The ints in princes and the ing in kings still rang in the dark room. Sometimes he wished he could sleep in the baby room. The constant waking and crying there might be more rhythmic. The older orphans had their irritating habits. One of Nurse Edna's John Wilbers slept on a rubber sheet. Homer would lie awake, waiting to hear him wet his bed. Some nights Homer would wake the child, march him to the toilet, point his tiny pecker in the right direction, and whisper, "Pee, John Wilber, pee now, pee here." The child, asleep on his feet, would hold it back, waiting for the welcoming rubber sheet, that familiar dent, and the warm puddle in the bed. Some nights when he felt irritable, Homer Wells would simply stand by John Wilbur's bedside and whisper his command in the boy's ear, "Pee," with almost instantaneous results. More upsetting was Nurse Angela's named child, the sickly little Fuzzy Stone. Fuzzy had a cough, a constant dry hack. He had wet, red eyes. He slept inside a humidified tent. A water wheel cranked by a battery and a fan to distribute the vapor ran all night. Fuzzy Stone's chest sounded like a tiny failing motor. The damp, cool sheets enclosing him fluttered through the night like the tissue of a giant semi-transparent lung. The water wheel, the fan, Fuzzy Stone's dramatic gasps, they merged in Homer's mind. If one of the three were to stop, Homer doubted he'd know which two were still alive. Dr. Larch told Homer that he suspected Fuzzy Stone was allergic to dust. That the boy was born and slept in a former sawmill was doubtlessly not the best thing for him. A child with chronic bronchitis was not easily adoptable. Who wants to take home a cough? When Fuzzy Stone's coughing was too much for Homer Wells, when the various engines that struggled to maintain Fuzzy were too much on Homer's mind, lungs, water wheel, and fan, Homer would quietly seek out the baby room. Nurse Angela or Nurse Edna was always there, usually awake and tending to one of the babies. Sometimes, when the babies were quiet, even the nurse on duty was sleeping, and Homer Wells would tiptoe past them all. One night, he saw one of the mothers standing in the baby room. She did not appear to be looking for her baby in particular. She was just standing in her hospital gown in the middle of the baby room, her eyes closed, absorbing the smells and sounds of the baby room through her other senses. Homer was afraid the woman would wake up Nurse Angela, who was dozing on the duty bed. Nurse Angela would have been cross with her. Slowly, as Homer imagined you might assist a sleepwalker, he led the woman back to the mother's room. The mothers were often awake when he went to peek in on them. Sometimes he would get someone a glass of water. The women who came to St. Cloud's for the abortions rarely stayed overnight. They required less time to recover than the women who had delivered, and Dr. Larch discovered that they were most comfortable if they arrived in the morning, shortly before light, and left in the early evening, just after dark. In the daytime, the sound of the babies was not so prevailing because the noise the older orphans made and the talk among the mothers and the nurses confused everything. It was the sound of the newborn babies that, Dr. Larch observed, upset the women having the abortions. At night, except for John Wilbur's peeing and Fuzzy Stone's cough, the waking babies and the owls made the only sounds at St. Cloud's. It was a simple enough observation to make. The women having abortions were not comforted to hear the cries and prattle of the newborn. You could not plan the exact hour for a delivery, but Larch tried to plan the abortions for the early morning, which gave the women the whole day to recover and allowed them to be gone by evening. Some of the women traveled a long way. In these cases, Larch recommended that they come to St. Cloud's the night before their abortions, when he could give them something strong to help them sleep. They'd have the whole of the next day to recover. If one of these women spent the night, it was never in the room with the expectant or delivered mothers. Homer Wells, in his insomniac tour of St. Cloud's, saw that in sleep the expressions of these overnight visitors were no more nor less troubled than the expressions of the women who were having, or who'd already had, babies. Homer Wells would try to imagine his own mother among the faces of the sleeping and the wakeful women. Where was she waiting to get back to when the pain of her labor was behind her? Or was there no place she wanted to go? And what, when she was lying there, was his father thinking? If he even knew he was a father. If she even knew who he was. These are the things the women would say to him. Are you in training to be a doctor? Are you going to be a doctor when you grow up? Are you one of the orphans? How old are you? Hasn't anyone adopted you yet? Did someone send you back? Do you like it here? And he would answer, I might become a doctor. Of course, Dr. Larch is a good teacher. That's right, one of the orphans. Almost 16. I tried being adopted, but it just wasn't for me. I wanted to come back. Of course I like it here. One of the women, very expectant, her belly huge under a taut sheet, asked him, Do you mean if someone wanted to adopt you, you wouldn't go? I wouldn't go, said Homer Wells. Right. You wouldn't even consider it? The woman asked. He almost couldn't look at her. She seemed so ready to explode. Well, I guess I'd think about it, Homer Wells said. But I'd probably decide to stay, as long as I can help out around here. You know, be of use. The pregnant woman began to cry. Be of use, she said, as if she'd learned to repeat the pigtails of sentences from listening to Homer Wells. She pulled down the sheet. She pulled up her hospital gown. Nurse Edna had already shaved her. She put her hands on her great belly. Look at that, she whispered. You want to be of use? Right, said Homer Wells, who held his breath. No one but me ever put a hand on me to feel that baby. No one wanted to put his ear against it and listen, the woman said. You shouldn't have a baby if there's no one who wants to feel it kick or listen to it move.
I don't know, said Homer Wells.
Don't you want to touch it or put your ear down to it? The woman asked him.
Okay, said Homer Wells, putting his hand on the woman's hot, hard belly.
Put your ear down against it, too, the woman advised him.
Right, Homer said.
He touched his ear very lightly to her stomach, but she strongly pressed his face against her. She was like a drum, all pings and pongs. She was a warm engine, shut off but still tapping with heat. If Homer had been to the ocean, he would have recognized that she was like the tide, like surf, surging in and out and back and forth.
No one should have a baby if there's no one who wants to sleep with his head right there, the woman whispered, patting the place where she roughly held Homer's face.
Right where? Homer wondered, because there was no comfortable place to put his head, no place between her breasts and her belly that wasn't round. Her breasts, at least, looked comfortable, but he knew that wasn't where she wanted his head. He found it hard to imagine, from all the noise and motion inside her, that the woman was carrying only one baby. Homer Wells thought that the woman was going to give birth to a tribe.
You want to be of use? The woman asked him, crying gently now.
Yes, be of use, he said.
Sleep right here, the woman told him.
He pretended to sleep with his face against the noisy boulder, where she held him snug. He knew when her water had broken before she knew it. She had fallen that soundly asleep. He went and found Nurse Edna without waking the woman, who before dawn delivered a 7-pound baby girl. Since neither Nurse Edna nor Nurse Angela was in charge of naming the girl orphans, after a few days someone there gave her a name, probably Mrs. Grogan, who favored Irish names. Or, if Mrs. Grogan had momentarily exhausted her supply, the secretary who typed badly and was responsible for Melanie instead of Melody. She also enjoyed naming the little girls. Homer Wells never knew which one she was, but he kept looking for her, as if his nighttime vigil with his face upon the mother's jumping belly might have given him the senses necessary to recognize her child. He would never recognize her, of course. All he had to go on was the fluid sound of her, and how she'd moved under his ear in the dark. But he kept looking. He watched the girls in the girls' division as if he expected her to do something that would give her away. He even admitted his private game to Melanie once. But Melanie was, typically, derisive.
"Just what do you think the kid's going to do so you'll know which one she is?" Melanie asked. "Is she going to gurgle? Is she going to fart? Or kick you in the ear?"
But Homer Wells knew he was just playing a game by himself, with himself. Orphans are notorious for interior games. For example, one of the oldest games that orphans play is imagining that their parents want them back, that their parents are looking for them. But Homer had spent an evening with the mystery baby's mother. He'd heard all about the mystery baby's father, and his lack of interest in the matter. Homer knew that the mystery baby's parents weren't looking for her. That may have been why he decided he'd look for her. If that baby girl was growing up, and if she was playing the old orphan's game, wouldn't it be better if there was at least someone who was looking for her, even if it was just another orphan? Dr. Larch tried to talk to Homer about Melanie's anger.
"Anger is a funny thing," Dr. Larch began, believing that anger was an unfunny thing.
"I mean, I agree. The passage about the gleams of sunshine, okay, it's sappy," Homer said. "It's just one of those things. It makes you wince when you read it. But it's just what Jane would say. It's just like her, so what can you do?" Homer asked. "But Melanie was violent about it."
Dr. Larch knew that Melanie was one of the few orphans still at St. Cloud's who was not born at St. Cloud's. She'd been left at the hospital entrance early one morning when she'd been 4 or 5.
She was always so big for her age, it had been hard to tell how old she was. She hadn't talked until she was 8 or 9. At first, Larch thought she might be retarded, but that wasn't the problem. Melanie was always angry, Dr. Larch tried to explain. We don't know about her origins or her early years, and she may not know herself what all the sources of her anger are. Larch was deliberating whether or not he should tell Homer Wells that Melanie had been adopted and had been returned more times than Homer. Melanie had several unfortunate experiences in foster homes, Dr. Larch said cautiously. If you have the opportunity to ask her about her experiences, and if she wants to talk about them, it might provide her with a welcome release for some of her anger. Ask her about her experiences, said Homer Wells, shaking his head. I don't know, he said. I never tried to talk to her. Dr. Larch already regretted his suggestion. Perhaps Melanie would remember her first foster family and tell Homer about them. They had sent her back because she allegedly bit the family dog in an altercation concerning a ball. It wasn't just the one fracas that upset the family. They claimed that Melanie repeatedly bit the dog. For weeks after the incident, she would creep up on the animal and surprise it when it was eating or when it was asleep. The family accused Melanie of driving the dog crazy. Melanie had run away from the second and third families, alleging that the men in the families, either fathers or brothers, had taken a sexual interest in her. The fourth family claimed that Melanie had taken a sexual interest in a younger female child. In the case of number 5, the husband and wife eventually separated because of Melanie's relationship with the husband. The wife claimed that her husband had seduced Melanie. The husband claimed that Melanie had seduced, he said attacked, him. Melanie was not ambiguous about the matter. No one seduces me, she told Mrs. Grogan proudly. In the case of number 6, the husband had died of a heart attack shortly after Melanie's arrival, and the wife had sent the girl back to St. Cloud's because she felt unequipped for the task of raising Melanie alone. Melanie's only remark to Mrs. Grogan had been, "You bet she's unequipped." All this suddenly, Dr. Larch imagined Homer hearing firsthand from Melanie. The vision disturbed him. He feared that he had made Homer Wells his apprentice, an attendant to the gritty operation of St. Cloud's, while at the same time he could not resist screening the boy from some of the harder truths. It was so like Nurse Angela, of course, to call Homer Wells angelic, and so like Nurse Edna to speak of the boy's perfection and of his innocence. But Dr. Larch worried about Homer's contact with the damaged women who sought the services of St. Cloud's, those departing mothers in whose characters and histories the boy must be seeking some definition of his own mother. And the troubled women who were scraped clean and went away leaving no one behind, just the products of conception, what impression did they make on the boy? Homer Wells had a good, open face. It was not a face that could hide things. Every feeling and thought was visible upon it, the way a lake in the open reflects every weather. He had a good hand for holding and eyes you could confess to. Dr. Larch was worried about the specific details of the life stories Homer would be exposed to, not simply the sordidness, but also the abundant rationalizations he would hear. And now Melanie, the undisputed heavyweight of the girls' division, had disturbed the boy with her anger, with what Dr. Larch suspected was only the tip of the iceberg of her power. Her potential for educating Homer Wells seemed to be both terrible and vast. Melanie began her contribution to Homer's education the very next evening when he read to the girls' division. Homer had arrived early, hoping to leave early, but he found the girls' dormitory quarters in disarray. Many of the girls were out of their beds, some of them shrieking when they saw him. Their legs were bare. Homer was embarrassed. He stood under the hanging bulb in the communal bedroom, searching the room without success for Mrs. Grogan, who was always nice to him, and clutching his copy of Jane Eyre in both hands, as if the wild girls were likely to tear it away from him. He did notice that Melanie was already in her usual position, in her expected brief attire. He met her eyes, which were piercing but withholding opinion. Then he looked down, or away, or at his hands, holding Jane Eyre. "Hey, you," he heard Melanie say to him, and he heard a subsequent hush fall among the other girls. "Hey, you," Melanie repeated. When he looked up at her, she was kneeling on her bed and shoving toward him the biggest bare ass he'd ever seen. A blue shadow, perhaps a bruise, discolored one of Melanie's straining thighs. Between the bulging, flexed cheeks of her intimidating buttocks, a single dark eye stared at Homer Wells. "Hey, sunshine," Melanie said to Homer, who blushed the color of the sun at sunrise or sunset. "Hey, sunshine," Melanie crooned sweetly to him, thus giving to the orphan Homer Wells her own name for him, Sunshine. When Homer told Dr. Larch what Melanie had done to him, Dr. Larch reconsidered the wisdom of allowing Homer to read to the girls' division. But to remove this chore from the boys' duties would constitute, Larch felt, a kind of demotion. Homer might suffer a sense of failure. The work at an orphanage is fairly decisive. When Wilbur Larch felt indecisive regarding Homer Wells, he knew he was suffering from the natural feelings of a father. The thought that he'd allowed himself to become a father and a sufferer of a father's indecision so depressed Dr. Larch that he sought the good piece of ether, to which he was becoming steadily more accustomed. There were no curtains at St. Cloud's. The hospital dispensary was a corner room. It had a south window and an east window, and it was the east window, in Nurse Edna's opinion, that made Dr. Larch such an early riser. The slim, white iron hospital bed never looked slept in. Dr. Larch was the last to bed and the first to rise, enhancing the rumor that he never slept at all. If he slept, it was generally agreed that he slept in the dispensary. He did his writing at night, at the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. The nurses had long ago forgotten why this room was called Nurse Angela's office. It was St. Cloud's only office room, and Dr. Larch had always used it for his writing. Since the dispensary was where he slept, perhaps Dr. Larch felt the need to say that the office belonged to someone else. The dispensary had two doors, one leading to a toilet and shower, which in such a small room created a problem with furniture. With a window on the south end and on the east wall, and a door on the north and on the west, there was no wall one could put anything against. The stark bed fit under the east window. The closed and locked cupboards, with their frail glass doors, formed an awkward maze around the dispensary counter in the middle of the room. It seemed fitting, for a dispensary, that the medicines and the ether cans and the hardware of small surgery should occupy the most central space. But Larch had other reasons for arranging the room this way. The labyrinth of cabinets in the middle of the room not only left access to the hall and bathroom doors, it also blocked the bed from the view of the hall door, which, like all the doors in the orphanage, had no lock. The cluttered dispensary afforded him some privacy for his ether frolics. How Larch liked the heft of that quarter-pound can! Ether is a matter of experience and technique. Imbibing ether is pungent but light, even though ether is twice as heavy as air. Inducing ether anesthesia, bringing one's patients through the panic of that suffocating odor, is different. With his more delicate patients, Larch often preceded his ether administration with 5 or 6 drops of oil of orange. For himself, he required no aromatic preparation, no fruity disguise. He was always conscious of the bump the ether can made when he set it on the floor by the bed. He was not always conscious of the moment when his fingers lost their grip on the mask. The cone, by the force of his own exhalations, fell from his face. He was usually conscious of the limp hand that had released the cone. Oddly, that hand was the first part of him to wake up, often reaching for the mask that was no longer there. He could usually hear voices outside the dispensary, if they were calling him. He was confident that he would always have time to recover. "Dr. Larch?" Nurse Angela, or Nurse Edna, or Homer Wells would ask, which was all Larch needed to be brought back from his ether voyage. "Right here," Larch would answer, "just resting." It was the dispensary, after all. Don't the dispensaries of surgeons always smell of ether? And for a man who worked so hard and slept so little, if he slept at all, wasn't it natural that he would need an occasional nap? It was Melanie who first suggested to Homer Wells that Dr. Larch possessed certain remote habits and singular powers. "Listen, sunshine," Melanie told Homer, "how come your favorite doctor doesn't look at women?" "He doesn't, believe me. He won't even look at me, and every male, everywhere, every time looks at me. Men and boys look at me. Even you, sunshine, you look at me." But Homer Wells looked away. "What's the smell he carries around?" "Ether," said Homer Wells. "He's a doctor. He smells like ether." "You're saying this is normal?" Melanie asked him. "Right," said Homer Wells. "Like a dairy farmer?" Melanie asked slyly. "He's supposed to smell like milk and cow shit, right?"
"Right," said Homer Wells, cautiously.
"Wrong, sunshine," Melanie said. "Your favorite doctor smells like he's got ether inside him, like he's got ether instead of blood." Homer let this pass. The top of his dark head measured up to Melanie's shoulder. They were walking on the tree-stripped and eroded riverbank in the part of St. Cloud's where the abandoned buildings had remained abandoned. The river there had eroded not only the bank, but also the foundations of these buildings, which in several cases did not have proper foundations or even cellar holes. Some of these buildings were set on posts, which were visible and rotting in the gnawing water at the river's edge. The building Homer and Melanie preferred had a porch that had not been designed to overhang the river, though it hung over the river now. Through the porch's broken floorboards, Homer and Melanie could watch the bruise-colored water rush by. The building had been a kind of dormitory for the rough men who worked in the sawmills and lumber yards of the old St. Clouds. It was not a building of sufficient style for the bosses or even the foremen. The Ramsey's Paper Company people had kept rooms in the Hoare Hotel. It was a building for the sawyers, the stackers, the yardmen, the men who broke up the log jams, who drove the logs downstream, who hauled the logs and cut lumber overland, the men who worked the mills. Usually Homer and Melanie stayed outside the building on the porch. Inside, there were only an empty communal kitchen and the countless sordid bunk rooms, the ruptured mattresses infested with mice. Because of the railroad, hobos had come and gone, staking out their territory in the manner of dogs by peeing around it, thus isolating the mattresses least overrun by the mice. Even with the window glass gone and the rooms half filling with snow in the winters, there was no ridding the inside of that building from the smell of urine. One day, when the weak spring sun had lured a black snake, sluggish with cold, to warm itself on the floorboards of the porch, Melanie said to Homer Wells, "Watch this, sunshine." With surprising quickness of hand for such a big girl, she seized the napping snake behind its head. It was a milk snake, almost 3 feet long, and it twined around Melanie's arm, but Melanie held it the proper way, tightly, behind the head, not choking it. Once she had caught it, she seemed to pay no attention to it. She watched the sky as if for a sign, and went on talking to Homer Wells. "Your favorite doctor, sunshine," Melanie said. "He knows more about you than you know, and more about me than I know, maybe." Homer let this pass. He was wary of Melanie, especially now that she had a snake. "She could grab hold of me just as quickly," he was thinking. "She could do something to me with the snake." "You ever think about your mother?" Melanie asked, still searching the sky. "You ever wish you knew who she was, why she didn't keep you, who your father was, you know, those things?" "Right," said Homer Wells, who kept his eyes on the snake. It wound itself around Melanie's arm, then it uncoiled itself and hung like a rope. Then it thickened and thinned, all by itself. Tentatively, it explored around Melanie's big hip. Appearing to feel more secure, it settled around her thick waist. It could just reach. "I was told I was left at the door," Melanie said. "Maybe so, maybe not." "I was born here," said Homer Wells. "So you were told," Melanie said. Nurse Angela named me, Homer offered in evidence. Nurse Angela or Nurse Edna would have named you if you'd been left, Melanie said. She still watched the sky. She remained indifferent to the snake. She's bigger than I am. She's older than I am. She knows more than I do, thought Homer Wells. And she has a snake, he reminded himself, letting Melanie's last remark pass. Sunshine, Melanie said absently, just think about it. If you were born here in St. Clouds, there's got to be a record of it. Your favorite doctor knows who your mother is. He's got to have her name on file. You're written down on paper. It's a law. A law, Homer Wells said flatly. It's a law that there's got to be a record of you, Melanie said. In writing, a record, a file. Your history, sunshine. History, said Homer Wells. He had an image of Dr. Larch sitting at the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. If there were records, that was where they would be. If you want to know who your mother is, Melanie said, all you got to do is look her up. You just look up your file. You could look me up while you were at it. A smart reader like you, sunshine? It wouldn't take you much time. And any of it would make more interesting reading than Jane Eyre. My file alone is more interesting than that, I'll bet. And who knows what's in yours? Homer allowed himself to be distracted from the snake. He looked through a hole in the porch floorboards at some passing debris, a broken branch, perhaps, or a man's boot, maybe a man's leg, was swept by in the river. When he heard a whistling sound, like a whip, he regretted taking his eyes from the snake. He ducked. Melanie was still concentrating on the sky. She was swinging the snake around and around her head, yet her attention was entirely on the sky, not on any sign that appeared there either, but on a red-shouldered hawk. It hung above the river in that lazy-seeming spiral soaring of hawks when they are hunting. Melanie let the snake sail out over the river, the hawk following it. Even before the snake struck the water and started swimming for its life, for shore, the hawk began to dive. The snake didn't fight the current. It raced with it, trying to find the angle that would bring it safely under the eroded bank or into the tangled bracken. "Watch this, sunshine," Melanie said. Along 10 yards offshore, the hawk seized the swimming snake and carried it, writhing and striking, aloft. "I want to show you something else," Melanie said, already turning her attention from the sky now that the outcome was clear. "Right," said Homer Wells, all eyes, all ears. At first the weight and movement of the snake appeared to make the hawk's rising a struggle, but the higher the hawk rose, the more easily it flew, as if the higher air had different properties from the air down where the snake had flourished. "Sunshine," Melanie called impatiently. She led him inside the old building and upstairs to one of the darker bunk rooms. The room smelled as if there might be someone in it, possibly someone alive, but it was too dark to see either the mice-invaded mattresses or a body. Melanie forced open a ragged shutter hanging by one hinge and knelt on a mattress against a wall that the open shutter had brought to light. An old photograph was tacked to the wall, in line with what had once been the head of someone's bed. The tack had rusted and had bled a rusty path across the sepia tones of the photograph. Homer had looked at other photographs in other rooms, though he had neglected this one. The ones he remembered were baby pictures, and pictures of mothers and fathers, he presumed, the kind of family photographs that are always of interest to orphans. "Come look at this, sunshine," Melanie said. She was trying to pick the tack loose with her fingernail, but the tack had been stuck there for years. Homer knelt beside Melanie on the rotting mattress. It took a while for him to grasp the content of the photograph. Possibly he was distracted by his awareness that he had not been as physically close to Melanie since he'd last been tied to her in the three-legged race. Once Homer had understood the photograph, at least he understood its subject, if not its reason for existing, he found it a difficult photograph to go on looking at, especially with Melanie so close to him. On the other hand, he suspected he would be accused of cowardice if he looked away. The photograph reflected the cute revisions of reality engineered in many photographic studios at the turn of the century. The picture was edged with fake clouds, with a funereal or reverential mist. The participants in the photograph appeared to be performing their curious act in a very stylish heaven or hell. Homer Wells guessed it was hell. The participants in the photograph were a leggy young woman and a short pony. The naked woman lay with her long legs spread-eagled on a rug, a wildly confused Persian or Oriental. Homer Wells didn't know the difference. And the pony, facing the wrong way, straddled her. His head was bent, as if to drink or to graze, just above the woman's extensive patch of pubic hair. The pony's expression was slightly camera-conscious, or ashamed, or possibly just stupid. The pony's penis looked longer and thicker than Homer Wells's arm, yet the athletic-looking young woman had contorted her neck and had sufficient strength in her arms and hands to bend the pony's penis to her mouth. Her cheeks were puffed out, as if she'd held her breath too long. Her eyes bulged, yet the woman's expression remained ambiguous. It was impossible to tell if she was going to burst out laughing or if she was choking to death on the pony's penis. As for the pony, his shaggy face was full of faked indifference, the placid pose of strained animal dignity. "Lucky pony, huh, Sunshine?" Melanie asked him. But Homer Wells felt passing through his limbs a shudder that coincided exactly with his sudden vision of the photographer, the evil manipulator of the woman, the pony, the clouds of heaven, or the smoke of hell. The mists of nowhere on this earth, at least Homer imagined. Homer saw briefly, as fast as a tremble, the dark-room genius who had created the spectacle. What lingered with Homer longer was his vision of the man who had slept on this mattress, where he now knelt with Melanie in worship of the man's treasure. This was the picture some woodsman had chosen to wake up with, the portrait of pony and woman somehow substituting itself for the man's family. This was what caused Homer the sharpest pain, to imagine the tired man in the bunk room at St. Cloud's, drawn to this woman and this pony because he knew of no friendlier image. No baby pictures, no mother, no father, no wife, no lover, no brother, no friend. But in spite of the pain it caused him, Homer Wells found himself unable to turn away from the photograph. With a surprisingly girlish delicacy, Melanie was still picking at the rusty tag, in such a considerate way that she never blocked Homer's view of the picture. "If I can get the damn thing off the wall," she said, "I'll give it to you." "I don't want it," said Homer Wells, but he wasn't sure. "Sure you do," Melanie said. "There's nothing in it for me. I'm not interested in ponies." When she finally dug the tack out of the wall, she noticed that she'd broken her nail and torn her cuticle. A fine spatter of her blood newly marred the photograph, quickly drying to a color similar to the streak of rust that ran down the pony's mane, across the woman's thigh. Melanie stuck the finger with the broken nail in her mouth and handed the photograph to Homer Wells. Melanie allowed her finger to tug a little at her lower lip, pressing it against her lower teeth. "You get it, don't you, Sunshine?" she asked Homer Wells. "You see what the woman's doing to the pony, right?"
"Right," said Homer Wells.
"How'd you like me to do to you what that woman is doing to that pony?"
Melanie asked him.
She stuck her finger all the way into her mouth then, and closed her lips around it, over the second knuckle joint. In this fashion she waited for his answer, but Homer Wells let the question pass. Melanie took her wet finger out of her mouth then, and touched its tip to Homer's still lips. Homer didn't move. He knew that if he looked at her finger, his eyes would cross.
"If you'd like me to do that to you, Sunshine," Melanie said,
"all you've got to do is get me my file. Get me my records." She pressed her finger against his lips a little too hard. "Of course, while you're looking up the file on me, you can look up yourself, if you're interested," Melanie added. She took her finger away.
"Give me your finger, Sunshine," she said.
But Homer Wells, holding the photograph in both hands, decided to let this request pass.
"Come on," Melanie coaxed. "I won't hurt you."
He gave her his left hand, keeping the photograph in his right. He actually extended his closed fist to her so that it was necessary for her to open his hand before she could slip his left index finger into her mouth.
"Look at the picture, Sunshine," she told him.
He did as he was told.
She tapped his finger against her teeth while she managed to say, "Just get me the file, and you know what you'll get." "Just keep the picture and think about it," Melanie said. What Homer thought was that the anxiety of looking at the photograph with his finger in Melanie's mouth, kneeling beside her on the mattress home of countless mice, would be eternal. But there was such a startling thump on the roof of the building, like a falling body, followed by a lighter thump, as if the body had bounced, that Melanie bit down hard on his finger before he could instinctively retrieve it from her mouth. Still on their knees, they lurched into each other's arms. They hugged each other and held their breath. Homer Wells could feel his heart pound against Melanie's breasts. "What the hell was that?" Melanie asked. Homer Wells let the question pass. He was imagining the ghost of the woodsman whose photograph he clutched in his hand, the actual body of the sawmill laborer landing on the roof, a man with a rusty ripsaw in each hand, a man whose ears would hear in eternity only the whine of those lumberyard blades. In that thump of dead weight upon the roof of the abandoned building, Homer himself heard the snarling pitch of those long-ago saws. But what was that sharp, almost human noise he heard singing above the buzz? It was the sound of cries, Homer imagined. The paper-thin wails of the babies on the hill, those first orphans of St. Cloud's. His hot cheek felt the flutter of the pulse in Melanie's throat. The lightest, most delicate footsteps seemed to walk the roof, as if the body of the ghost after his fall were changing back to spirit. "Jesus!" Melanie said, shoving Homer Wells away from her so forcefully that he fell against the wall. The noise Homer made caused the spirit on the roof to scurry and to emit a piercing two-syllable shriek, the easily identifiable whistle of the red-shouldered hawk. "Kier!" the hawk said. The hawk's cry was apparently not recognizable to Melanie, who screamed, but Homer knew instantly what was on the roof. He rushed down the stairs, across the porch to the wrecked rail. He was in time to see the hawk ascending. This time the snake appeared easier to carry. It hung straight down, as true as a plumb line. It was impossible to know if the hawk had lost control of the snake, or if the bird had dropped the snake intentionally, realizing that this was a sure, if not entirely professional, way to kill it. No matter, the long fall to the roof had clearly finished the snake, and its dead weight was easier to bear away than when it had lived and writhed in the hawk's talons and had repeatedly struck at the hawk's breast. Homer noted that the snake was slightly longer and not quite as thick as the pony's penis. Melanie, out of breath, stood on the porch beside Homer. When the hawk was out of sight, she repeated her promise to him. "Just keep the picture and think about it," she repeated. Not that Homer Wells needed any instruction to think about it. What a lot he had to think about. "Adolescence," wrote Wilbur Larch. "Is it the first time in life we discover that we have something terrible to hide from those who love us?" For the first time in his life, Homer Wells was hiding something from Dr. Larch, and from Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna. And with the photograph of the pony with its penis in the woman's mouth, Homer Wells was also hiding his first misgivings concerning St. Larch. With the photograph, he hid his first lust, not only for the woman who gagged on the pony's amazing instrument, but also for the inspired promise Melanie had made him. Hidden with the photograph, under his hospital bed mattress pinned against the bedsprings, were Homer's anxieties concerning what he might discover in the so-called files, in the imagined record of his birth at St. Cloud's. His own mother's history lay in hiding with that photograph, which Homer found he was more and more drawn to. He took it out from under the mattress and looked at it three or four times a day, and at night, when he couldn't sleep, he looked at it in candlelight, a drowsy light in which the woman's eyes appeared to bulge less violently, a light in the flicker of which Homer imagined he could see the woman's cheeks actually move. The movement of the candlelight appeared to stir the pony's mane. One night, when he was looking at the picture, he heard John Wilbur wet his bed. More often, Homer looked at the picture to the accompaniment of Fuzzy Stone's dramatic gasps. The cacophony of lungs, water wheel, and fan seemed appropriate to the woman and pony act that Homer Wells so fully memorized and imagined.
Something changed in Homer's insomnia. Dr. Larch detected the difference, or else it was the deception within him that made Homer Wells conscious of Dr. Larch's observations of him. When Homer would tiptoe down to Nurse Angela's office late at night, it seemed to him that Dr. Larch was always at the typewriter, and that he would always notice Homer's careful movement in the hall. "Anything I can do for you, Homer?" Dr. Larch would ask. "Just can't sleep," Homer would reply. "So what's new?" Dr. Larch would ask. Did the man write all night? In the daytime, Nurse Angela's office was busy. It was the only room for interviews and phone calls. It was full of Dr. Larch's papers, too, his correspondence with other orphanages, with adoption agencies, with prospective parents. His noteworthy, if occasionally facetious, journal, his whatnot diary, which he called A Brief History of St. Clouds. It was no longer brief. And it grew daily, every entry facefully beginning, "Here in St. Clouds," or "In other parts of the world." Dr. Larch's papers also included extensive family histories, but only of the families who adopted the orphans. Contrary to Melanie's belief, no records were kept of the orphans' actual mothers and fathers. An orphan's history began with its date of birth, its sex, its length in inches, its weight in pounds, its nurse-given name, if it was a boy, or the name Mrs. Grogan of the girls' division secretary gave it, if it was a girl. This, with a record of the orphan's sicknesses and shots, was all there was. A substantially thicker file was kept on the orphan's adoptive families. Knowing what he could about those families was important to Dr. Larch. "Here in St. Cloud's," he wrote, "I try to consider, with each rule I make or break, that my first priority is an orphan's future. It is for his or her future, for example, that I destroy any record of the identity of his or her natural mother. The unfortunate women who give birth here have made a very difficult decision. They should not, later in their lives, be faced with making this decision again. In almost every case, the orphans should be spared any later search for the biological parents. Certainly, the orphans should, in most cases, be spared the discovery of the actual parents. I am thinking of them, always of them, only of the orphans. Of course, they will one day want to know. At the very least, they will be curious. But how does it help anyone to look forward to the past? How are orphans served by having their past to look ahead to? Orphans especially must look ahead to their futures. And would an orphan be served by having his or her biological parent, in later years, regret the decision to give birth here? If there were records, it would always be possible for the real parents to trace their children. I am not in the business of reuniting orphans with their biological beginnings. That is the storytelling business. I am in the business for the orphans. That is the passage from A Brief History of St. Clouds that Wilbur Larch showed to Homer Wells when he caught Homer in Nurse Angela's office going through his papers. "I was just looking for something, and I couldn't find it," Homer stammered to Dr. Larch. "I know what you were looking for, Homer," Dr. Larch told him, "and it is not to be found." That is what the note said, the one Homer passed to Melanie when he went to the girls' division to read Jane Eyre. Each night they had repeated a wordless habit. Melanie would stick her finger in her mouth. She appeared to stick it halfway down her throat, her eyes bulging in mockery of the woman with the pony. And Homer Wells would simply shake his head, indicating that he hadn't found what he was looking for. The note that said, "not to be found," provoked a look of profound suspicion on Melanie's restless countenance. "Homer," Dr. Larch had said, "I don't remember your mother. I don't even remember you when you were born. You didn't become you until later." "I thought there was a law," Homer said. He meant Melanie's law, a law of records or written history. But Wilbur Larch was the only historian and the only law at St. Cloud's. It was an orphanage law. An orphan's life began when Wilbur Larch remembered it. And if an orphan was adopted before it became memorable, which was the hope, then its life began with whoever had adopted it. That was Larch's law. After all, he had taken the necessary responsibility to follow the common law regarding when a fetus was quick or not yet quick.
The rules governing whether he delivered a baby or whether he delivered a mother were his rules, too.
"I've been thinking about you, Homer," Dr. Larch told the boy. "I think about you more and more, but I don't